This one's cartoonish, I gotta say.
Yeah, so according to Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative, it's only bribery if it comes from the bribery region of France, right?
Good line.
Everything else is just sparkling corruption.
That sounds about right. Although, our guest today may feel differently about it.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't. Nothing's right.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From the Bribery region of France, otherwise known as Los Angeles and Pacifica Radio, this is the Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle's KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, who's feeling better, I'm hoping, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for the Bradcast. As discussed in our latest Green News report later this hour, environmentalists, not to mention a lot of other folks, are still waiting, sort of waiting on edge here for a major ruling from the Supreme Court regarding the so-called Chevron deference or Chevron doctrine, which could determine whether, as has been the case for decades now, whether deference is given to experts, for example, scientific experts at executive agencies like the EPA, to set rules and regulations on legislation passed by Congress that may be vague on certain points. To sort of oversimplify that, and Desi Doyen, correct me here if necessary.
Okay.
But currently, for example, Congress may pass a law that says water must be clean and drinkable. And the federal agencies then put that into practice by determining what the regulations need to be in order to determine what clean and drinkable actually means.
Right.
And if those rules are then challenged by a corporation or something in court, and it's unclear exactly what Congress meant in their law, deference on that should go to the experts at the federal agency. Do I have that about right?
Yes. Basically, judges should not insert their policy preferences over an agency's scientific expertise. They should defer, thus the Chevron deference.
If the court limits or ends that deference, which is now very possible to happen, we will see. That's what everyone's waiting on. Well, that would take away a huge amount of power from actual, governmental experts and would hand it to essentially corporations and commercial trade groups.
And unelected judges.
Unless Congress gets very, very specific about each and every rule and regulation in the text of the legislation itself. So this could be a huge blow to executive agency power. Or as folks on the right, like Steve Bannon, have described it, an end to the so-called administrative state. That's what they have been trying to do. It's been long been a goal on the right to take power away from government and hand it to, private corporate interests, in this case, via judges who are not experts in these things. So that ruling still remains as we go to air here. That remains to come this term. And in fact, we are still waiting on a number of key rulings from the stolen, packed and corrupted right-wing Supreme Court, including on presidential immunity to absolve Donald Trump of as many crimes related to his failed attempt to steal the 2020 election and some other stuff that now appears as if it may actually come after the usual end of the SCOTUS term, which is usually over by the end of June, which means it will, these decisions will come after we will be on a holiday break ourselves. So you may be on your own to make sense of some of these things for now over the next week, along with making sense of the first presidential debate scheduled earlier in the year than ever. So before the presidential candidates are even officially nominated by their own parties at this summer's national conventions. But I suspect there's going to be plenty of folks covering that debate for you in the days ahead. But I wanted to mention that Chevron deference coming up any moment within the next few days. And by the way, the irony of it, there's a bit of irony.
Oh, there's a lot of irony in this one.
Involving the Chevron deference was
established in 1984 in the Supreme Court case, Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council.
Right.
The Reagan administration tried to put through some rules that were going to not do as much pollution control as the Natural Resources Defense Council thought they should.
Right.
And so the EPA under Reagan said, no, our definition is just fine. Doesn't need to be that strict. So that is how that ruling initially came about. And there's a bit of an irony to this one, because the head of the Reagan EPA.
Yeah, what was her name?
Ann Gorsuch.
That name rings a bell.
And it should, because she's the mother of Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch.
Really?
Yes. And so back in 1984, when Ann Gorsuch said, yeah, no, we can't make these pollution rules better. Our scientists say we don't have to, and you guys should defer to that. Now, conservatives, of course, loved the Chevron deference for a long time.
They used to love it.
Until they realized that, oops, Democrats and environmental groups can use it too.
When they're in power, when they're running the EPA.
And also, yes, and when there are pollution rules or any other kinds of rules that need to be passed, environmental groups started using the Chevron deference to say, hey, the scientists over at this agency say you got to do this. And so that doctrine continued for many, many years. But now, because we have a new fully stolen and packed right-wing Supreme Court supermajority, this new Supreme Court supermajority now finally has enough justices to overturn or limit the Chevron deference.
To overturn what it was that Neil Gorsuch's mom had argued in favor of initially.
Justice Gorsuch has been gunning for this his entire career.
And I suspect he will not be recusing himself from this ruling, even though his mom was
part of that.
Part of it. Okay.
So they could limit, they could overturn it, and if they overturn it, boy, it's a whole can of worms.
And not just for the EPA, but for a whole bunch of federal agencies.
Yes,
the deconstruction of the administrative state.
You called it a agency power. I would call it agency authority. The authority granted to them from Congress that delegates the details of how to enforce these laws.
Keep your eyes on that in the next few days. In the meantime, I want to stick to largely to the Supreme Court today. However, as we're going to discuss some seemingly counterintuitive thoughts with a guest joining us shortly, a former top federal prosecutor, regarding one of the rulings that we discussed on yesterday's broadcast that you heard cleverly referenced at the top of the show by the nation's Elie Stahl legal expert, as he and many other legal experts over the past 24 hours have been describing the court's decision in Snyder v. U.S. as having legalized bribery for state and local public officials. We sort of characterized it that way as well when we discussed it on the show yesterday. In fact, that may not be exactly right, as our guest shortly may be able to clarify for us. But first, there were a number of other important rulings that were released by the corrupted High Court on Thursday. They rejected a billions-dollar nationwide opioid settlement with OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family, which owns it, that would have shielded members of that family from civil lawsuits, but also have provided billions of dollars to combat the opioid epidemic. That was a 5-4 split decision with, believe it or not, both liberals and right-wingers falling in both the majority and the minority. The court also, in a partisan 6-3 split, stripped the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, of the ability to carry out in-house proceedings on civil fraud complaints, finding that those accused of fraud by the SEC have a right to a regular federal jury trial, a ruling that could have far-reaching effects as well on other regulatory agencies, making it much harder to take action against fraudsters and corporate entities. So this is another clear win for those corporate interests from this corrupt corporatist court, and a ruling that we actually got a preview of on Wednesday when the court accidentally posted the ruling to its website for a few minutes before it was taken down, a ruling that clears the way for Idaho hospitals to provide emergency abortions in a state that otherwise bars all abortions other than when the mother is literally on death's door. That in response to a Biden administration notice to all states after Roe v. Wade was overturned, that a Reagan-era federal law requiring emergency treatment, even if it includes abortion, must be given even in states that have banned abortion. In this case, however, while that ruling sounds good today, it actually applies only for probably the next year or so as the case is heard in the lower courts. It is actually sort of a punt. It will almost certainly come back to the Supreme Court, though not, as the justices certainly know, during a presidential election year, which many are suggesting is why the court's right-wingers essentially wanted to kick the can down the road for a bit here.
Yeah, because you wouldn't want to have a political bomb like that drop right before the election. God forbid voters should understand that.
Yeah, we'll wait and hold that until after they're not looking next year. But yep. They also issued yet another troubling environmental decision on Thursday that I do want to get Desi's thoughts on here. Like a good neighbor, our rotten, packed, corrupt, corporatist Supreme Court is definitely not there today in its ruling in a case called Ohio v. EPA, challenging the Environmental Protection Agency's so-called good neighbor rule to curb smoke and smog emitted by dirty power plants, etc., from polluting downwind neighboring states. The EPA will not be able to enforce this key rule limiting air pollution in nearly a dozen states while separate legal challenges proceed around the country under the Supreme Court decision on Thursday. The EPA's good neighbor rule is intended to restrict smokestack emissions from power plants and other industrial sources that burden downwind areas with smog-causing pollution. Three energy-producing states, Ohio, Indiana, and West Virginia, challenged the rule along with the steel industry and some other groups, saying it was too costly and ineffective. Well, it doesn't appear to be ineffective at all. In fact, in the states that have applied it, emissions have dropped some 18% over the past year. In any event, the Supreme Court put the rule on hold while the challenges in court continue below in what is the so-called conservative-led court's latest blow to federal regulations, specifically here, federal environmental regulations and the ability of the EPA to do the job that it was mandated to do by Congress. In this case, the ruling was 5-4 with Neil Gorsuch writing for the majority, saying that he believed the states are likely to win in the end among the factors justifying their decision to block the plan for the moment. In dissent, however, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, she joined with the three liberal colleagues of hers as she wrote that she doubted that the states and industry would ultimately prevail here. Nice to see Barrett get on the right side of the issue with the other ladies on the court. But with a 6-3 right-wing majority overall, the court has increasingly reined in the powers of federal agencies, including the EPA in recent years, for example, their ability to regulate carbon dioxide emissions from power plants and so forth. So, Desi, what is the good neighbor rule? What does this pause, at least for now, actually mean?
Well, first of all, remember, pollution does not respect borders. So maybe if we called it migrant pollution, Republicans would care about it. But anyway, this is for pollution that drifts downwind across state lines. Imagine if you're sitting behind a polluting truck and you get a tailpipe full of their pollution into your face. That's what downwind states are facing. And it also makes it harder for downwind states to meet their own ambient air quality rules under previous laws.
For example, here, states like Wisconsin, New York, Connecticut say they struggle to meet federal standards and reduce harmful levels of ozone as they're trying to because of pollution from out-of-state power plants and cement kilns and natural gas pipelines that drift across the border.
Yeah, so remember, this is important because these emissions cause smog and they are linked to asthma and lung disease and premature death. So by putting a temporary pause on implementing this rule while it wends its way through the lower courts, it will basically make it possible for people to continue to be harmed by this pollution for many, many, many years. Basically, I think the best way I've seen it put was the Supreme Court rules that people should have dirtier air for a while until the courts work out whether or not they should have dirtier air permanently.
New York's Deputy Solicitor General told the court that for some states, as much as 65% of smog pollution comes from outside its borders. So even if they're doing the right thing, a neighboring state who is not is going to make their people, particularly the elderly, particularly children playing outside, going to make them sick. In fact, 1,300 deaths per year, I think, was the number last year.
And that's probably an undercount, but yes.
From this sort of thing, from asthma and pollution and so forth.
Right. So keep in mind that this is a standard to protect public health and people who breathe. So it's a problem that the Supreme Court has decided that, we don't really need to know about this until later. And I just want to add that this ruling is just stacked on top of all of the other previous rulings from this supermajority, right-wing supermajority, that have been chipping away at the EPA's authority to address climate change and water pollution and air pollution.
The rule is actually being put in place in mostly Democratic-leaning states right now: Illinois, Indiana, Maryland. Well, Indiana's not, but Maryland, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Wisconsin. But it's on hold in another dozen states, all Republican-controlled by and large. So, disturbing decision today. I guess it's not about the health of the public.
No.
That's not a concern for this Supreme Court.
But anyway, I should add there are metrics, various metrics to these rules that the EPA promulgates. And generally, every dollar that is spent on complying with new pollution rules returns between $5 to $8 in economic benefits from not killing as many people and from just generally benefits to public health and lack of
benefits
pollution.
To the public, but not necessarily benefits to the corporations.
Indeed.
All right. Let's take a quick break. From allowing deadly air pollution to allowing blatant corruption by public officials. Yeah, it's that same Supreme Court. That's our corrupted, packed, and stolen court right now. But let's take a quick break. We'll come back with a top former federal public corruption prosecutor for a somewhat different take on Wednesday's Snyder v. U.S. case, which overturned a conviction against an Indiana mayor who received a $13,000 gift after awarding a $1.1 million contract. George Washington University's Randall D. Eliason joins us next on the broadcast as we are still trying to make sense of it all. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Mac. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. And then there was Wednesday's ruling at the U.S. Supreme Court on corruption by public officials, something they know quite a bit about, I think, which we discussed in some detail on yesterday's program and that you may have heard or read many in the media since, describing as the right-wing U.S. Supreme Court majority actually legalizing bribery and or corruption. My guest joining me momentarily, a former top federal corruption and bribery prosecutor, however, apparently sees it somewhat differently and is here to explain why. But briefly, as we detailed at some length yesterday, former Portage, Indiana Mayor James Snyder was heavily in debt when he became mayor of the town back in 2012. The town was in need of new garbage trucks, and after Snyder became the mayor, he took over the procurement and public bidding process after he had set the requirements so that only one company in town, two brothers who owned a local truck dealership that Snyder was in close touch with, only they were able to meet the requirements for this $1.1 million city contract. They were awarded that contract by Snyder, and then about 2 weeks after it was finalized, the mayor went and met with the two brothers to explain his own personal financial woes. He told them he needed money, and they basically handed him a check for $13,000, supposedly for some sort of undefined consulting services. The deal was investigated by the FBI, and Snyder was eventually indicted by federal prosecutors under a federal bribery statute. Snyder argued, however, in his defense, that what he described as an after-the-fact gift was not actually bribery as defined by the federal law. That bribery, as made more and more difficult to prosecute over the years thanks to previous Supreme Court rulings, must be a direct quid pro quo. You give me that, I'll give you this, before a public act or a contract in this case could be was awarded. And that an after-the-fact gift, in this case, that $13,000 check that the brothers gave to the mayor, well, that was little more than sort of a thank you gift, a gratuity, a tip, if you will, that was not barred by the federal bribery law. Neither the federal judge in Snyder's case nor the U.S. Appeals Court in Chicago bought the claim that Snyder was selling, and he was in fact convicted and sentenced to 21 months in prison. But his appeal went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which accepted it, and on Wednesday, in a 6-3 partisan split decision, the court's right-wing majority overturned Snyder's conviction, agreeing with him that an after-the-fact gratuity was not, in fact, prohibited under the federal statute. That, even though federal law had already allowed such after-the-fact gifts with a value no more than $5,000, and even though the statute has been used for years to prosecute other similar cases. As Justice Brett Kavanaugh, writing for the Republican majority, said, quote, "The question in this case is whether the federal law also makes it a crime for state and local officials to accept gratuities, for example, gift cards, lunches, plaques, books, framed photos or the like that may be given as a token of appreciation after the official act. The answer," he wrote, "is no, it's not a crime." Apparently, that is not a federal crime as defined by the law in question as the court majority now sees it. Even if, as in this case, the so-called gratuity, the tip, if you will, was a $13,000 check given as thanks to a public official for a public act that included a $1.1 million contract. Of course, it was far beyond a gift card or a lunch or a plaque or a framed photo. In her blistering dissent on behalf of the court's three liberals, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote that the mayor's, quote, "absurd and atextual reading of the statute is one only today's court could love," adding that the law, as written, quote, "poses no genuine threat to common gift-giving, but that it, quote, clearly covers the kind of corrupt, albeit perhaps non-quid pro quo payment, that the mayor solicited after steering the city contracts to the dealership." The ruling by the High Court is the latest in a years-long series by that court that has made it more and more difficult for federal law enforcement to bring bribery and corruption charges against public officials. Two convictions, for example, for two aides of then New Jersey Governor Chris Christie were thrown out after those two officials had conspired to shut down lanes to the George Washington Bridge because the court ruled that they had not sought money or property when they tried to strong arm a local mayor into supporting Christie. He didn't, and they shut down the bridge. And perhaps most famously in 2016, Virginia Governor Bob McDonald, who accepted $175,000 in luxury gifts from a businessman, was let off the hook as well because he took what the court saw as no official actions to actually benefit the guy, even though he had helped him introduce his vitamin supplements at a governor's mansion party, as I recall, etc. But the court said, nope, that's not bribery. That's not corruption. So making it more difficult to prosecute public officials for public corruption has been an ongoing project for a while by this court. And yet, our friend and longtime guest Randall Eliason, a former top federal prosecutor, appeared on Twitter on Wednesday after the ruling came out in Snyder v. U.S. and had a very different take from other legal experts and analysts, tweeting, quote, "I have no problem with the Snyder decision that 18 U.S.C. 666 covers only bribes and not gratuities. I think that makes sense. The key distinction," he writes, "is the intent to influence. A bribe requires corrupt intent to influence the official action or to be influenced if you're the official. A gratuity can just be a thank you for an act already taken. No intent to influence required." Now, I am anything but certain about that particular take, but I do respect Eliason a lot. And as he formerly headed up the DOJ's public corruption unit in D.C., well, I'd like to learn more. Joining us now is Randall D. Eliason, the former chief of the Fraud and Public Corruption Section at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia. He now teaches white-collar criminal law at George Washington University Law School, contributes to The Washington Post, The New York Times, and others, and blogs at his own site, sidebarsblog.com. Okay, counselor, when I think of public fraud and corruption, I think of you. And well, that may not be exactly sounding right.
I guess that's a good thing.
Welcome back to the broadcast, nonetheless, sir. Good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be back.
So I will bite. You have no problem, quote, no problem with the Snyder decision ruling that 18 U.S.C. 666 only covers bribes but not gratuities, and found that it, quote, makes sense. How does that make sense, Randall?
Okay, well, there's a few different things, I think, to sort out here.
Okay.
The first is I'm not happy about the outcome. You're right that there's been a pattern of decisions over the last more than a decade narrowing public corruption laws, and I've been critical of a lot of them. I think I've been on your program being critical of a number of them in the past,
mm-hmm.
You know, certainly including the McDonald decision I'm very critical of that you mentioned. So yeah, that is a problem, and I'm not happy about the outcome, but I don't think the majority is being unreasonable in this particular decision, because what this decision is about is not about whether the conduct of this mayor was a good thing or whether it should be prohibited. It's just about the language in this particular criminal statute that Congress drafted, and it's really a badly drafted statute. It's poorly written. It's confusing. And even though the lower court in this case had upheld his conviction, several other federal courts of appeals had said the same thing, that this law does not apply to gratuities, and agreed with Snyder. And that there was a split in the courts of appeal, which is one reason the Supreme Court took the case.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't completely out of the blue that the Supreme Court did this. There was disagreement even among the federal courts of appeal. And it's based on the wording of the statute. This distinction between a bribery and a gratuity is a real thing in federal law. That's not something that, you know, was just made up in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And federal law, other statutes do prohibit both of them, bribes and gratuities. And there is a real distinction between them, which, like you quoted in my tweet, has to do with whether you're trying to influence the official's actions. That's a bribe. That's the pure corruption. You're corrupting the process by influencing what they do. They're going to act now because you're paying them off, not because they're acting in the public interest. Where a gratuity is like a tip, an after-the-fact thank you, that doesn't influence what they did. It just rewards them after the fact or gives them this gift after the fact. So there is that is a real legal distinction. And the question was, does this particular corruption statute that applies to corruption by state and local officials and entities that get federal funds, does it apply to both or does it just apply to gratuities? Mm-hmm. And the statute was unclear because it had some confusing language in it. On the one hand, it said it requires corrupt intent, which suggests that's the language of bribery. But then it also had the word reward in there, which is what the entire dissent hinges on, basically that single word, and say reward suggests a gratuity. And I agree with that. So there's ambiguity, conflicting language, confusion in there.
And let me just,
when that happens, generally, the tie goes to the defendant.
Well,
criminal statutes are supposed to be interpreted. And this is what Justice Gorsuch said in his concurrence. Because there's confusion, there's this rule called the rule of lenity that says basically we err on the side of the defendant and say, you know, that the statute is narrower, not broader.
Well, let me read part of Justice, since you referenced it, Justice Jackson's dissent for the minority. She notes Section 666 imposes federal criminal penalties on agents of those who, quote, corruptly solicit, accept, or agree to accept payments, quote, intending to be influenced or rewarded. How was the $13,000 check for unspecified consulting services right after the contract was given, if not intended to influence the decision, how is it not clearly a reward as written in the statute for this huge contract that they just won?
Yeah, I mean, that's the basis of the conflict. Like I said, also in the lower courts of appeal, which is that corrupt language, corruptly influenced or rewarded, you know, is kind of internally inconsistent because typically gratuities, gifts don't require that kind of corrupt intent. So is this really a bribery statute or does it cover both? And I'm not disagreeing that it's confusing or ambiguous. And I'm not saying the dissent's position is crazy. I'm just saying I think the majority probably has the better of the argument when you consider all of the factors they listed to explain why they thought this couldn't cover gratuities, which includes, among other things, the fact that the penalty is exactly the same, even though gratuities are typically punished at a far less severe level than bribes. It's 15 years for bribe, 2 years for a gratuity in the other federal statute. If this statute applied to gratuities, it would mean federal officials would take gratuities, because this law doesn't apply to federal officials.
Right.
It would mean federal officials are subject to a 2-year penalty for gratuities, but state and local officials would be subject to a 10-year penalty, which doesn't make any sense. Why would Congress do that? There was evidence that Congress originally included language about gratuities in this statute and then 2 years later took it out, which suggests they realized they didn't want to do that. And that's why they changed the statute. So, you know, the majority had 6 or 7 different reasons. And I'm not happy about the outcome because I think it's a poorly written statute. And, you know, but I think the majorities came to the reasonable decision and there's an easy fix. They're not saying bribery is okay. They're saying, you know, the gratuities are okay. They're just not covered. Congress can fix that easily if it wants to, and if we had a functional Congress.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say that's not quite easy.
They could have fixed McDonald too, and that hasn't happened yet.
Right.
But
it doesn't
happen.
The point
is, it's not about what it's not about. So you see a lot of headlines in the wake of this decision. Supreme Court says bribery is okay.
Right.
Well, the whole point was it wasn't bribery. It was a gratuity, which is something far less serious. And the issue was just, does this particular statute cover this kind of gratuity? Their answer was no. I think based on the way that statute was written, it's a reasonable outcome.
Well, she keeps underscoring the plain text of the 666, which is, you know, something that this particular court, the textualists say that, oh, when there's a question about a law, you go back to the text of the simple reading of the text. And she keeps referring to that, the plain text that, you know, it's unlawful to accept payments, quote, intending to be influenced or rewarded, which does seem clear. But she also notes that the court concludes that the statute does not criminalize gratuities at all. This is so apparently because, quote, state and local governments often regulate the gifts that state and local officials may accept, which, according to the majority, means that Section 666 cannot. So, yes, there are state and local statutes that also do apply to such gifts, but why does that alone mean that the federal statute cannot do so as well?
Yeah, I wouldn't say alone. I mean, it was one of the six reasons I think the majority identified, but their argument is you're kind of whipsawing state and local officials if you do that, because state law might say, for example, a gratuity up to $200 is fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's lawful for you to accept a gratuity as long as $200 or less. And the majority's point is if you got a state or local official, their state law is saying they can take that $200 gratuity, but the federal law would say they can't. And so, you know, how do they know which one actually governs them? Or even if they think they're complying with state law, do they need to worry about a federal prosecutor coming in and charging them? Now, that being said, I agree with Justice Jackson's point that what the majority does here is they kind of take little trivial examples like a photo frame and a $100 gift card
right,
and use that to make their argument, when that's not what this case is about.
Right.
Right. And they do this all the time. They did it in McDonald's. They take fanciful future prosecutions about, you know, poor politician, they're going to indict him for bribery because he took a free breakfast from the Rotary Club if we don't narrow the statute the way McDonald wants us to.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what they do, and I agree with her criticism of that they shouldn't take these trivial potential prosecutions and say, oh, we've got to narrow this statute to prevent prosecutors from bringing these cases that they're never going to bring in the first place.
Right.
But I still kind of I just disagree with her that the language is so plain. I think there is some internal inconsistency in the language of the statute that explains why the majority disagree said what she did. Yeah.
Yeah. She says both the majority and Snyder suggest that interpreting 666 to cover gratuities is problematic because it gives, quote, federal prosecutors unwarranted power to allege crimes that should be handled at the state level. But woulds, coulds, and shoulds of this nature must be addressed across the street with Congress. Isn't that what the so-called conservatives have been arguing for years now? That sure, a statute may be poorly written, or prosecutors may wish it did something other than what it, you know, is clearly specified in the plain text, but that the answer is for Congress to change that if they don't like it, not to have activist judges doing so, you know, legislating from the bench. Isn't that essentially what the court's so-called conservative majority is doing in this case?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that's not illegitimate to me. I mean, the idea when we're doing statutory interpretation, that's a reasonable response. In other words, you say, this is what we think the statute says.
Mm-hmm.
Our best analysis of what we think the statute says, if we are wrong, Congress can change it. They're not interpreting the Constitution. It's not like Dobbs or something, you know. Mm-hmm. They're interpreting what Congress did, and if Congress thinks they got it wrong, Congress can come back and change it. And that has happened in the past in various criminal statutes. So that's a perfectly legitimate point for the court to make, that, you know, and Justice Kavanaugh says this, we think this is what the statute means. If Congress doesn't like it, they're free to change it. The problem is Congress is so dysfunctional these days.
Right. And they ain't never going to change.
The reality is that doesn't happen.
But right.
That is the way it's supposed to work. Congress is supposed to write clear statutes. And if the court finds that they're not clear, they're internally inconsistent somehow, they rule, and then Congress can come back and fix it.
And in simple terms, as you've described it to me, that essentially, if there's sort of good points to make on both sides, if it's a tie, then the tie is supposed to go to the defendant. And in the bargain, they're not saying you can't prosecute for gratuities. They're saying that state and local laws that deal with that are certainly free to move forward, and that Congress is free to be more specific, I guess, in future laws on this if they ever, you know, write another law again. But
exactly.
Randall, does this particular, and this came up a lot since this ruling on Wednesday, does this particular federal law, this specific one, whatever it is, Section 666, does it apply to public officials who are, say, Supreme Court justices, who might, you know, receive a gratuity as a thank you gift from someone?
This particular one does not, because it does not apply to federal officials.
Uh-huh. It only applies to state and local officials. Are there other laws that do apply to federal officials that have to do with thank you gratuity tips?
Absolutely. The federal gratuities law, it's mentioned in this court's in the opinion in this case. It's 18 U.S.C. 201. It's the same law at issue in McDonald. 201B prohibits bribery and 201C prohibits gratuities. So if you had a Supreme Court justice where you could prove that a particular gift was for or because of a particular decision, in other words, it's not just the general goodwill, I think you're doing a great job here, Mr. Justice, and here's a bunch of money, but it's linked to a particular official action, and that potentially violates a very clear federal gratuity statute, 18 U.S.C. 201B.
But you would have to, I was going to correct you there. That's C.
But you got to link it to a particular decision or action. You can't just say in general, because I think he's doing a great job.
You can't just say, hey, Clarence Thomas, here's millions of dollars in luxury travel and a motor coach and so forth, because we think you're doing a bang up job on the court. Even if it's millions of dollars, it wouldn't make a difference because it's not tied to a specific action after a specific case or something like that.
It might violate all kinds of other rules and norms and things like that. It's not a federal gratuity.
Gotcha.
Unless you can link it to a specific official action.
All right. Yeah. Well, you are, frankly, much more forgiving in one sense than I am about all of this, because, boy, I mean, it is really, you know, we have been watching, as you noted, for years, the court has made it more and more and more difficult to bring cases for public corruption and bribery and that sort of thing. As a former public corruption prosecutor yourself, how did that affect your ability to bring these public corruption cases? How does it affect the ability for prosecutors now? Do they have anything left to prosecute at this point?
Well, there's no question it makes it a lot harder. And I think public corruption prosecutions are down about 50% since the McDonnell decision, for example. And clearly not impossible. You got Senator Menendez on trial right now, right? Mm-hmm. You've got Representative Cuellar, who was just indicted. I mean, it's clearly not impossible. But it's much more difficult, and the hoops that the prosecutors have to jump through are a lot higher and more numerous. one more point before we go, though, because another bit of misinformation that you see a lot about this decision is that this means as long as the public official is smart enough to not get their payment until after they act, then they're going to be in the clear, right?
Yeah.
That's not right. If there was an agreement to act a certain way, that's the crime. It doesn't matter when you get paid. In other words, the key distinction is whether you agreed to be influenced or not.
Right.
If you did, and then you had a deal, and then you went and voted that way or whatever, and then you got the money later, that's not a defense under this statute, because the crime is the agreement. The crime is not the later payoff. So it's not the timing of the payment so much. The distinction is, can the government prove there was a deal just to be influenced in how you exercise your powers exchange for that payment?
If there was no deal, if I just did a good thing for you for some reason as a public official and then went back to you later and say, hey, you know what? By the way, remember that great deal I did for you? Well, now I could use something for me, if you don't mind. I really need to pay my mortgage. Could I have some money?
Right.
That would be okay because they didn't agree to it in advance.
Well, it's not a bribe. Okay.
Right.
Now, it might be a gratuity, depending on if it's a federal official. It's not a gratuity under this law that was just decided.
Gotcha.
There are a lot of other laws out there, a lot of other legal theories, and there are state laws as well. But under 18 U.S.C. 666, basically what you described is what happened here. The mayor goes to them later and says, hey, how about that solid I did for you? Can you give me some money?
Yeah.
And they did it. Doesn't violate this one particular statute. That doesn't mean it's okay.
And it doesn't mean that the local and state officials can't bring charges for that very same thing. Does this ruling at the court on Wednesday, does it open up the possibility that other plaintiffs who were convicted under this statute might seek a rehearing or see their cases overturned?
I think potentially the rules about when these things apply retroactively are very complicated. So I think it's kind of case by case, but you could definitely see some defendants who were earlier convicted for this now come back and try to get those convictions vacated.
Well, thank you for adding some light and some clarity, because it is very easy to be just enervated by this maddening ruling. But I'm glad to hear that maybe there is some sort of sense to it. Randall Eliza, before I let you go, I know you've been waiting and watching very closely for the SCOTUS opinion that is expected in the Fisher case at any moment now, which could end up tossing out hundreds of convictions for January 6th defendants charged with obstructing an official proceeding, including Donald Trump, who's facing that charge in two of his four felony counts that he's been indicted on for in Jack Smith's federal case related to his attempt to steal the 2020 election through insurrection and other means. Very quickly, what are you watching for there, and how do you expect the court is likely to come down?
Well, I'm pessimistic, I guess. I mean, I've been in the minority. I've been kind of cautiously optimistic that maybe the court would uphold the statute, because here that I think you could take Justice Jackson's dissent in Snyder and make it the majority opinion in Fisher if you can persuade a couple of the other justices who purport to be textualists to, because I think in that case the statute is clear. I don't think there's that any kind of internal confusion like there was in 666, and the statute clearly applies to the Capitol riot. And justices like Gorsuch and Barrett, you know, if they're going to be true to their textualist principles, they should agree with that. But I'm not super confident. It seems like, especially
that they should agree to
the
uphold.
Now,
they should agree to uphold the Fisher case, the Fisher charges.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think it's probably more likely that you'll get a split similar to what we saw in Snyder, where the majority will say this obstruction statute's ambiguous. If we construe it the way the government wants us to, in the future, they might prosecute innocent lobbyists or peaceful protesters who stand up during a committee hearing and shout some kind of protest before they're escorted out. And, you know, we can't give prosecutors that kind of power. They'll make the same kind of argument about trivial future cases that in the real world would never be brought, but they'll use it as a way to narrow the statute. This time, though, I think they would really be violating the clear language of the statute, and that would be unjustified, but a lot of people expect that to happen.
Oh, boy. And they would. But there's also an argument to be made that even if they do that, the specifics of the charges brought against Trump specifically for obstructing a federal proceeding, since they have to do with documents and the fake electors certificate, even if they throw out the Fisher case and for hundreds of other defendants, they may not throw out those charges against Donald Trump. Is that your reading?
That's
as well?
Right. Yeah, depending on how they word it, but I think there's a good chance. I mean, they definitely won't throw them out. A judge would have to do that later. But I think there's a good chance the charges against Trump would still survive, because, like you say, the way they would limit this statute is probably to say the obstruction has to be linked to destruction of some kind of actual evidence. Just a riot to shut down the proceeding as a whole is not enough. It has to be linked to some kind of evidence impairment or destruction. But in Trump's case, the prosecutors can argue that that was true because of the fake electors scheme, that they were trying to submit false documents, false evidence in as part of this proceeding by sending the phony electors, potentially by having the real ballots discarded or destroyed. So, again, depending on how they word it, but I think there's a good shot that the charges against Trump himself, no matter what the court does in Fisher, will still survive.
Excellent. And I'm going to get out on that note before you ruin the good news, Randall. Randall Eliason, former chief of the Fraud and Public Corruption section at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia. Boy, I hope they don't shut that down now that fraud and public corruption is almost over. Anyway, he teaches white-collar criminal crime at George Washington University Law School. You should sign up for his Substack newsletter at sidebarsblog.com and follow him on the site, still known as Twitter, at RD Eliason. Randall, always great speaking with you, my friend. Thank you very much. Have a lovely holiday, and I hope to talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. All right, let's take a quick break here, and we will come back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report.
Yeah.
Which has some good news in it.
It does.
For a change. Yay. That's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. Right now, as much as ever, if you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via bradblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Oh, wish someone would stop the world. All right, let's get to it. Desi Doyen, our latest Green News Report.
This caused major flooding and all sources of water were compromised.
New Mexico town grapples with cascading consequences of simultaneous weather disasters.
These justices are doing everything in their power to make it impossible for the government to fight the climate crisis.
Environmentalists on edge awaiting critical Supreme Court ruling. Plus, good news, Joe Biden's climate law has created more than 300,000 clean energy jobs.
All of that good news and, as usual, bad news straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I mean, some of the conservative justices might as well have ExxonMobil stitched across their robes like they're race car drivers.
Good point, Mark Joseph Stern. Though they're not conservative, they're just corrupt. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, a lot of folks are on edge as we go to air today. We start with the corrupted Supreme Court.
Yes, we do. As we go to air, we are waiting on the U.S. Supreme Court to issue a ruling that legal analysts fear will further strip federal agencies of authority to regulate pollution and climate warming emissions. The case itself, Loper Bright versus Raimondo, is about fisheries regulation, but at heart, it is a vehicle backed by industries who hope to use the case to overturn a decades-long precedent called the Chevron deference, which directs judges to defer to an agency's expertise and reasonable interpretations when laws aren't explicit. If the right-wing supermajority overturns or limits the Chevron deference doctrine, a host of major regulations and policies could be on the chopping block, like the Inflation Reduction Act and the EPA's new standards curbing air and water pollution and toxic emissions from power plants.
It would mean, as Steve Bannon likes to say, the end of the administrative state.
Yes. In other news, the summer of record extreme weather disasters is underway with a vengeance. This week, it's catastrophic flooding in southern China. Days of relentless, record-shattering rainfall set off flooding and landslides that have killed at least 71 people in Guangdong Province and displaced tens of thousands. India is still in the grip of a record-setting heat wave. Officials there warn the country is facing a record third year in a row of falling wheat production due to repeated rounds of extreme heat. Climate change, driven by the burning of fossil fuels, is making heat waves more likely, more intense, and longer lasting. In some regions, five times more likely. And June 2024 is now all but certain to clock in as the hottest June on record globally, the 13th month in a row to set a new temperature record for that month, according to scientists at Berkeley Earth.
Someone stop that clock.
Here in the U.S., torrential rains in New Mexico over the last few days have helped tamp down raging wildfires.
Oh, that's good.
But also triggered flash floods on prior wildfire burn scars that swept debris and ash into the river that supplies water to the town of Las Vegas, New Mexico.
It's like disaster upon disaster.
Yes, the town's water system is now shut down. All non-essential businesses are closed, and the city is distributing water to residents. Their situation highlights the rising costs of simultaneous climate disasters. But there is some good news.
Good.
On the economic impacts of President Biden's landmark climate law, the Inflation Reduction Act.
Good.
A new analysis finds that since Biden signed the IRA 2 years ago, which incentivized manufacturers to bring production back to America, companies have announced nearly $350 billion in investments in the clean energy sector alone.
$350 billion.
The biggest recipients of the law are Republican controlled congressional districts, whose representatives all voted against it.
Go figure.
But that hasn't stopped congressional Republicans from taking credit for projects at groundbreaking ceremonies.
Naturally.
A different analysis calculates that 313,000 new clean energy jobs have been announced or moved forward by companies since Biden signed the IRA. The new data showing the economic boom from Biden's climate policies across the country underscores the stark contrast between Biden and Donald Trump in the 2024 election. Trump and congressional Republicans have promised to dismantle Biden's climate laws and pollution standards and expand fossil fuel production if they win in November. On MSNBC, climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann was blunt about the high stakes of the November election.
A second Trump presidency would be more or less game over for climate action. It would be game over for domestic climate policy. And as goes the U.S., goes the rest of the world when it comes to action on climate.
I'm sure it'll all be fine. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. We're off next week for the Independence Day holiday. We will see you thereafter. Have a safe and happy one. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang.
Yeah.
Have we mentioned yet that elections have consequences and voting really, really, really matters?
No, you haven't mentioned that for 4 or 5 minutes, so I'm glad you bring it up. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to hit one of those donate buttons when you get to Bradblog, or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. As you heard the man say there, we will be off next week. Now, that said, the last, anytime we've taken time off, I think going back till Christmas, Des, either one or both of us has spent that time off sick, being sick.
Let's not do that.
Let's not do that for a change, shall we? We'll see how it goes. In the meantime, you folks are going to be on your own. On the other hand, I don't expect anything but a huge news explosion over the next week or so. So take care. Good luck. We'll be back soon.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot.
Drop me email if you like. I may read it while I'm gone at bradcast@bradblog.com. You can also find me on the Facebooks, Twitters, and Mastodons at The Brad Blog. You can find Desi there as well. She is Green News Report.
Please come by and say hi.
That's it. Have we covered it all?
I think we have.
Oh, thanks to our guest today.
Oh, yeah.
Randall D. Eliason of George Washington University School of Law. All right, that's it. We're out of here. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang. Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang. I love the way you walk. I love the way you talk. When you walk, and talk that talk. You knocked me out. Out off my feet.